Want to start off with a photograph here of one of Henry Moore's more interesting sculptures. We put it on camera before. This is a mother and child. It's a Madonna, in a way. The inner form is the infant, the child, and the outer form is the maternal, the mother. And the second example is a family group of three done in an abstract way. And these works of Henry Moore are world famous. And part of what we have been talking about here, we'll come around to this kind of imagery. This is the 11th lecture in the sequence on art. And there'll be one more next week, so that every one of these sequences runs 12 Saturdays. And the reason for the 12 is that it's an archetypal form. We've talked about how in our cultural bones, 12 months of the year, 12 disciples, 12 signs of the zodiac, how this 12-part quality, especially to archetypal things, things to do with the earth, actually, are in 12s. And this is true in other civilizations and not just our own. In China, the standard Taoist typology is that things to do with heaven are tens, and things to do with earth are 12s. And they call that the 10 earthly stems and the 12, the 10 heavenly stems and the 12 earthly branches. That somehow the cosmic influence comes down to us. And when it comes down to us, instead of staying in a celestial mode, which would be like a 10, just like the old perfect 10, that it becomes 12 when we're here on Earth. And the reason for that is very clear in China, although in the West it's been obscured and lost, because our origins in this particular area back in the ancient Middle East, I mean really archaic Middle East, this is before Sumeria, our origins are so lost that we still, only in some occult traditions, remember how the transition comes. But in China, it's very clear. Because in China, there is a five-phase energy cycle. And that five-phase energy cycle has two ways in which it can be, yin and yang. And so 2 times 5 makes 10. So that in a celestial typology of things, you can have either yin or yang through a five-phase energy cycle. And if you diagrammed it, you would get something like a sine wave, which is the way that you would register electronically an energy. Energy always has a pulsation. It's always in the form of a wave. In fact, it's a universal form. Wherever you have two waves that crisscross at that juncture, you have the possibility of a particle. You have a possibility of something being in existence. But that five-phase energy cycle, which begins with Tao, and the only way to even imagine what Tao is to give it a designation of zero. The Western zero is very close to what the Taoist would understand by Tao. It's there, but you can't count it. It's like if you have K counting 1 through 9, and then you get to 10. 10 is a 1 and a 0. Well, the 0 in 10 is part of its Tao. In other words, it's a form, but it's a form not of existence, but of ordering, of like something in the background that doesn't register in existence, but nevertheless influences however existence gets to be. So it's like a phantom form. And wherever there are intersections of energy waves making existent things, their existence is distributed by the orders of these forms. And the indexing order is Tao, the zero. And so the five-phase energy cycle begins with Tao, and where one would be, the second phase, is called Te. And the Chinese by Te mean that it has the oomph of oneness, that it has the quality of being what it is. And this quality is one of the most puzzling qualities there is. With Tao, you can be mystical and you can sort of intuit, but with Te, it's very difficult, because the only way to focus on Te is through a very complex quality of yoga, of being able to focus on one thing only. Single-mindedness about single-pointedness. In Buddhism, it was called ekagrata, and it was the ace quality of a yoga, was that you were able to attain this single-pointed mindedness, single-point-mindedness, ekagrata. The Chinese te is like that, and it's the quality that makes anything that exists real. It's objectively real because of Te. But its Te is courtesy of Tao. And in a way, the relationship between Tao and Te is the archetype that sets up the way that yin and yang work. So if you were to lie with a white lie, you would say that Tao is yin and Te is yang. It's not really that way, but it works out that way in actual practice. So the five-phase energy cycle is Tao, Te, and then in the third phase, because you're working with zero, which cannot be counted, and you're working with one, which is only itself, nothing else, the third phase, where we are, our souls, our spirits, our nature, the Chinese term for it is Jian, human-heartedness. They don't mean mind, they mean human-heartedness. That the human heart is the place in the cosmos, in the universe, where there's a perfect equilibrium between one and zero. That the human heart is so refined, so magnanimous in scope, so courageous in presentation, that the human heart is the only place that one and zero balance themselves perfectly. And so that human-heartedness is the third phase in that energy cycle, Tao, Te, Jin. And when they're in perfect balance, when one and zero, when Tao and Te are perfect, heartfully balanced, that's when for the first time the mind kicks in. That the mind is the fourth phase in that energy cycle. But it isn't anything simple, and it isn't there just by itself. It has to come in to play through the pilot light of the heart. And if the heart is not activated, then the mind doesn't really come into play. Some kind of surrogate, pseudo-mind, comes into play, like the ego. Now, the Chinese term for the mind was just simply yi. Yi. Yi also means the changes, like the I Ching. And Yi refers really to symbols. So the changes in the I Ching, those changes are symbolic forms that are so scintillating and active that they're all the time iridescent. But their iridescence is a variation play on themes that are set all the way back by the indexing order of Tao. So that there's a very interesting quality that Tao, Te, Jen, Yi, that those four phases, those first four of the five-phase energy cycle, set up a quality of juxtaposition that results in the Chinese term for the fifth phase is the 10,000 things. They always use that phrase, the 10,000 things. You can substitute the word multiplicity, or you can substitute the world. All of the things of the world, the sandbox of the universe is there in that fifth phase. And that fifth phase, because it's indexed by Tao, because it's bona fide by Te, because it's paired and balanced by Jen, because it's scintillating and iridescent by Yi, by the symbols of the mind, it has a nature where it's like a shimmering veil that were it all collected together at any one time, it would disappear into the oneness of Tao again. This is the veil, this is the veil of the goddess of nature. This is her shimmering gown that she wears. She wears all the stars and all the galaxies in the universe as sequins on her veil. And if she were to end her dance and pull her veil off, her nudity would be the absolute beginning of Tao pure, with nothing there. And so this is an odd quality. And all five of these phases, all five of these energy phases work at the same time all the time. At any given instant, they're always there, but there's an inflection for one or the other, or the other, or the other. And that inflection is due to the energy pulse of yin and yang. So there's always this quality that the way in which energy flows, it's like a liquid flow of the most wonderful fluid possible. It's the liquid flow of existence itself, has this kind of modulation. Now, when you take an image of energy and you see that sine wave activity, if you intensify energy, the sine wave changes. The next level of intensity in that sine wave makes it, instead of this kind of wobbly line, it makes a kind of a beginning of a crest at the top of the wobbles, so that you get this kind of scalloped quality to it. And if you intensify the energy even further to a third level, the scallop increases its cut and makes a kind of a curve so that what you get are like waves, like big curving waves. And you'll see, if you look at the ancient Near East about 2000 BC, about 4,000 years ago, say like, I guess the best known example is on Crete, the Palace of Minos on Crete. The decor in the royal palace room has as a frieze at the top, below all the illustrations of natural things, it has this wave in this particular manner. And it's a sign that those people were tremendously energized. And when you look at the physiological form of those people, they're like athletic dancers. the men and women all have the wasp waist. They all have the trim but muscular legs. They all have the V-ing kind of torso and the even shoulders. They are men and women who are at home, who are mobile in a syncopated high energy tone. And indeed, they're very, very high energy. In fact, their tombs, curiously enough, their tomb style, that Tholos style, is called the beehive style of ancient architecture. So they have that energy of like the hum of busy bees, and their bodies, their physiology shows that. And you can see in the symbolic key of their decor that they were indeed at a very high energy. Now, if you raise that energy to a fourth level, if you intensify it beyond that, those waves curl into vortexes. And those vortices look just like the Tai Chi symbol. So that energy, when it's in that kind of a wave form, if raised to a fourth level of intensity, you get whirlpools of mystery. And that's the level where really high Dharma beings see that and live in that way. On that level of intensity, nature flows back into Tao and leaves no trace whatsoever. You don't get any postcards. That's it. But it doesn't mean that they're gone. It means that they're everywhere. Because on that level of energy, infinity and zero are not only exchangeable, but they're interchangeable. In the 60s, the phrase was both and, which is a typical Berkeley reductionism, because it isn't both and at all. It's much deeper than both and. What was meant in the 60s by both and was cute bookends for a kind of a scene, which was okay. It's fine. But what's being talked about here is different. If you look at the structure of a galaxy, a galaxy is a Tai Chi vortex. It's very, very high energy. The difficulty with this kind of cosmic vortex, though, is that it is so large compared to our scale of living that no one recognized this until, well, the late 1920s was the first time. And it was done right here in Los Angeles. It was done up here, Mount Wilson. A guy named Edwin Hubble, who actually made a catalog. It was the first catalog of galaxies. And many people just didn't believe it. I said, "You're crazy." But he wasn't crazy. What's interesting when you look at a galaxy is that it doesn't have the Tai Chi that's separated abstractly by a symbol mental filter. The Chinese symbol of the Tai Chi, the yin-yang symbol that you see, is what a galaxy looks like when it's filtered through the abstraction of a mind. The mind, even though it seems nebulous, is nevertheless a sieve. It's a reductive sieve. And it cuts things down. That's its whole purpose, is to cut things down to size so you can deal with them. Bite size universe. I mean, we wouldn't be able to chew if we didn't have the mind to, you know, to cut our food. But when it's uncut, the Tai Chi looks like the whirling spiral, like the spiral spirit. And that's the spirit. That's the guiding star. That's our angel for the next couple thousand years, is that spiral spirit. But that spiral spirit only comes into play when balance is activated. Because until balance is achieved and activated, the mind doesn't learn something new. The heart has to be together with itself before we can learn something new. It's a very curious thing. We never learn anything new until our heart is alive. And the liveliness of the heart comes from balance. The deepest quality of imbalance in the heart is either too much yang or too much yin. Now, to put it in sociological terms, our particular civilization that we've come out of is way, way too much yang. I'm sure you've heard of it. And I know all of you women have grown up with the experience that it's crazy, it's insane. It isn't that it's a paternal situation. It isn't that it's a masculine situation. It's that it's a crazy situation. It doesn't make sense in terms of life. And this is true. Because the object was not to live. The object was to win at a game. Because the mind, when it doesn't come from a balanced heart, it does what it's meant to do. It abstracts, it veils, it goes into its reductive counting thing, and it loves then to set up oppositions, them against us, polarities, yes and no. These kinds of qualities that then egotistically take the place of yin and yang. Now remember that the Chinese typology had 10 in the celestial realm. So that the five-phase energy cycle has a yin and a yang. And in the cosmos, it works pretty well. I mean, when we get there, God will have to get some lawyers. But in the meantime, we're limited here to the Earth. And the Earth, then, to the Chinese, has a 12 quality rather than a 10. How come? Because they figure that you can't do an end run around the way in which the ego commandeers the game, because the ends of it are the Tao or the totality of the 10,000 things. You can't do an end run around, you can't go beyond zero or beyond infinity. So the Chinese, typical, blunt, no-nonsense Chinese, they decided just to plow right through the center. What's wrong with just bullying our way through the center? And so the Chinese take the middle. They take where we are. And they double it. And because it's doubled, it has yin and yang twice. So you have 2 times 2, which is 4. And so in the earthly quality, the 10 has a double right in the center. The third of the 5 becomes 2, and that with its yin and yang becomes 4. And so then you have a 12 part. And so things to do with the earth are 12 part. So curiously enough, archetypally, the zodiac, the 12 signs of the zodiac, has nothing to do with heaven. It has only to do with earth. The 12 apostles have nothing to do with Jesus. They have only to do with getting the message out on earth. The 12 hours of the day, the 12 hours of the night, they have nothing to do with the universe. They have only to do with this particular clod. I'm using derisive language because it's Hollywood, right? So to the Chinese, it makes really good sense to remember that when you're dealing with the reality of the way in which the universe works on Earth, to keep in mind that where we are has a very definite square, 2 times 2, 4. It has a quaternity. It has a four-cornered quality to it. And this 4 quality is not really 4, it's 2 times 2, it's 2 twos. 2 squared. Now, this happens to be a universal quality of assessment that after you look at human beings by the millions for thousands of years and keep records of it so someone can get used to that scale so that you can see the galaxy of mankind. You see what we are in the largest form, the form of mankind as a whole. Then you begin to see that there's a typology of the way in which we do things, and that the fulcrum of that typology is that there are two basic outlooks. One outlook is an outward, an extrovert outlook, and the other outlook is an introvert. Now, we're familiar with these types because it's made popular in the 20th century by Carl Jung, psychological types. And everyone talks about introvert and extrovert. But if you go to Jung's psychological types, he tells us that his writing on this particular subject in this particular way is word for word from Schiller. And that's why we're using Schiller in our education and not Jung, because we don't have time. We don't have time for derivatives. Somebody said this is the age of Mach 1 speech. I mean, you gotta hit it and hit it fast, because the other person's drawing their words and it's like shootout time. We only have time for Schiller. We don't have time for you. But let's cheat and take time for one little sentence here from you. I love his language. It follows conclusively from this passage. He's quoting Schiller. In fact, he's quoting the very book that we're using. Isn't that amazing? Where is that comb? It follows conclusively from this passage that through the observation of antagonistic mechanisms, isn't that great? Antagonistic mechanisms. Schiller arrived at the conception of two psychological types which claim the same significance in his presentation as I ascribe to the introvert and the extrovert. With regard to the mutual relation between the two types established by myself, I can endorse almost word for word what Schiller says of his. Schiller, in harmony with what I pointed out earlier, reaches the type from the mechanism, since he, and then he goes on in this way. Well, if you've been reading in Schiller, you know he's not very mechanical. In fact, he's famous for being non-mechanical. He's the author of the libretto of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which is all about freedom, right? I think we showed an engraving of Schiller with his cape, his long hair, and his foxskin trimmed lapels, and his big star from one of the princes in Europe, and his aquiline features. Jeez, I'm tall when I sit up. And great pals with Goethe and Beethoven and that crowd. And what he was saying in his work had to do with the quality that personality has, that the person has. That somehow the real form that's at play here is not introvert and extrovert, but person. It isn't masculine or feminine, it's person. But person in a way that the masculine, feminine, introvert, extrovert, form a square. They form a quaternary. And so the way in which our mind, through its little pointy head, can get this, the only way that it gets this, is that it has to draw this veil, this diagram veil, and look through the window. The mind is not like the heart. The mind is not courageous, right? Angels go in, or humans go in where angels fear to tread. Minds are like angelic. They want to make sure that they're delivering the right message to the right person. Is this right? Angels are not, they're not known for that kind of courage. I know it's the age of the angel, but it's man that's courageous. It's men and women who are courageous in this universe. If you tell an angel what they have to go through in life, no way. In Taoism, the saying was that you could always tell a Taoist master because the pupils of their eyes were square. You look in their eyes and they have square pupils. See how that happens? Any little resistances of matter? Look at that. That's the way it is. Looking through that square, seeing that the balance of introvert and extrovert, masculine and feminine, that quaternary, when those four qualities are balanced together, Jen, human-heartedness, has a certain tone. And that tone is like a wake-up call for the mind to realize that what it is. First of all, it realizes that it has limits. It's not the big honcho at all. It has limits. But that its limits are very peculiar. Its limits are zero and infinity. And it's very, very interesting for the mind to suddenly get that wake-up call from the heart and sober up and realize that in between zero and infinity, that the only balance that really holds is oneness. And in between zero and infinity, one is the only place that equanimity holds itself, cinches itself, becomes firm enough so that it's a place where existence could be. And so the energy wave of zero and the energy wave of infinity, when they crisscross together, their intersection makes a place, a locus, where oneness, where existence can happen. But the human heart is the only place where existence comes not to a dead stop, but to a still point, a still point of the heart. And there, on the still point of the heart, you can strike the flint of infinity with the motion of zero, and you get a spark that ignites the mind to come into self-realization. And then, for the first time, and only then, does it begin to get it. Does it learn that it's just been running a patois of commercials, infomercials of sociological advertisers that, no way. There are no Pepsi franchises on the moon yet. Socrates, in the character, in the plays of Plato, and before they were philosophical works, they were really plays. They were dramas of the mind. Socrates, as the protagonist, is always trying to get across to these arrogant, stubborn Athenian young men that they have only opinions. They don't really know anything. But what's even more insidious, they cannot learn anything new. Why? Because they do not know how to be companions to each other. They don't know how to interrelate with another human being so that two human beings make an equanimity together. He says many places, four or five places in the dialogues, he says, until we become companions together, we don't really know anything that's true. Because truth is that quality of singleness which we arrive at together. And when we arrive at it together, when we both together arrive there at that single pointedness, we realize that it's communal. Yes, it is unique. Yes, it is highly individual. It is that silence inside, but it also is that it's communal. We all have that silence inside. And those silences align themselves in such a way that it's such a pure line that it's just motion itself. Motion going through that five-phase energy cycle so quickly that one doesn't even notice, because time, what does Virginia Woolf say in To the Lighthouse? She says, art is a form which creates sudden instances of eternity within human lives. And the person who can do this is the artist, and the person who can share this is the lover. And that's what it's all about. That's what it's about. All the rest are infomercials. Now that quality, that particular tone has a kind of language that can be used. Let me just use some phrases now and see how this sounds to you. Art is the objectivization of vision. Art brings visionary consciousness into prismatic play. Art focuses the differential for a duration called the existence of the experience of the work of art. So that when we experience a work of art, if we're really experiencing a work of art, that work of art invites us into this durational participation and a moment, a nanosecond, a picosecond of eternity is able to be elongated for the duration of that work of art, of the experience of that work of art. And as we get better and better at this, we get to extend our duration more and more. It's just like a yogi, a young yogi, when first has that moment of insight, it's just there and gone before the snap of the fingers. But after a lot of diligence and a few knuckle wraps and some hard times in the cemeteries, sages used to camp out in cemeteries. It was the only place that you were safe from robbers. Nobody's going to go to the cemetery to rob you. And it's a good place to look at the ephemeral nature of things. But after long practice, you see that because it's not in time, that moment can be elongated, can be stretched. Virginia Woolf called it psychological time. And a moment in psychological time can be very long. We wean ourselves from clock time, and we come into psychological time through the participatory experience of art. And so the artist, in a way, is a helper, a companion to us. And that work of art is like a shared meal. It's like a banquet. It's like our communion together. And not only one person with one artist in a work of art, but unlimited numbers of people. If you watch that video of Leonard Bernstein directing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony when they were pulling the wall down in Berlin, and just before the symphony, and you saw the look on the people's faces, the Berliners, who for several generations had had this enormous death wall through their city. And they were watching the cranes tear it apart. and you saw on their faces this kind of discovery that underneath all of the horror and the travail, all the tension, all of the complications, is this wonderful simplicity of the heart when the heart is balanced. And if only that could be extended. For those of you who were here in Los Angeles during the Olympics and experienced that incredible quiet that Los Angeles had sociologically during the Olympics, incredible tone, kindliness, human kindness, was literally there everywhere in the city, even in the ghettos. One would like to extend that. One would like to elongate that. And one discovers that you can do that. And that art is that vehicle which brings the heart into that interface with the mind. So that we can say here that art focuses the differential for a duration. That duration is called the experience of the work of art. And allows within that the prismatic play. And that prismatic play is the energy of vision. And when the energy of vision plays within an elongated duration of art, a new quality comes out, a new energy comes out, a new process comes out that was not there before. And that new energy, that new process is called history. History in no way exists in nature. History in no way, in any kind of integral form, participates. History is a differential energy, very high. Very high. If you look at energy in nature, it has that sine wave quality. And if you look at energy in myth, the next process, the second process, it has that scalloped effect. And if you look at energy in the very high intensity of vision, used to be called magic or mystic, if you look at it, energy in that has that kind of waveform, crested waveform that the ancient Minoans used on their friezes. But if you look with that fourth level intensity at energy in history, it has those Tai Chi vortices. But because they're ostensibly vortices suspended in an openness, a space, history is the most difficult of all energy levels to work with. Because unless you're like a high planes drifter, you're going to get caught in the little scenarios of the whirlpools every single time. And so on this particular planet, the struggle with history as an energy form has only been about 6,000 years. And almost no one has been successful for a long time in dealing with navigating between the vortices. Now, because when it was beginning about 5,000 years ago, ancient Egypt was the best at dealing with this navigation over the vortices of nature. Nature transformed into myth, myth transformed into vision, vision transformed into history. But the difficulty with the Egyptian was that they took the individual archetype of the earth and assumed that that was going to be able to be projected all the way through into historical energy. And so the Egyptians got bogged down in cosmic size dead end. They were unaware of it. In fact, almost no one, even today, is aware of it. But it's like a dead end, a box canyon, so large compared to the scale that most people operate in, that it seems like openness. And yet, on the archetypal level, it's still a box canyon. It's still reductive. So one of the tasks of this particular education over the next couple of hundred years is to help an educational process to be able to energize and get out of that particular box canyon. We know now, our generation and the generation before us have seen that the dead end of history is a dead end of our species, unless we learn how to deal with it. Let's take a break and we'll come back. Let's come back with another Henry Moore sculpture. Three forms, so it's a family. Abstract, so that it's symbolic, mental. And these are three forms that are in a family of cylindrical space out of travertine marble. And now let's come to Eric Neumann's volume on the archetypal world of Henry Moore, which we used earlier in our art. Again, we're using books like legs. We're using pairs of books so that we can take steps. And so during the two-year course of this journey together, we have a form of locomotion, a dynamic form, which is capable of being taken naturally and capable of being taken in a visionary sense and capable of being taken all the way through to a cosmic wholeness. Walking is that for us. The sage who inherited Gandhi's India, Vinoba Bhave, was called the walking saint. And Vinoba used to say that walking was the correct pace of thinking. Plato's school, the academy, was a huge garden. And all of Plato's dialogues are conversations that take place as you walk. And there's a quality to walking. And when that particular quality is brought into language, cadence, you get a pristine form that evaporates out of myth into symbol very easily, like a light chiffon instead of something very heavy. And the very best person who ever did this, whoever used a refined poetic language based on the cadences of walking to make language forms, books that were light enough to evaporate into the mind, was Henry David Thoreau. And Thoreau's writing is extremely sophisticated. It's like an American Upanishad. Of course, it's never commercial at first. His first book, the Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, they printed in Boston 1,000 copies, and they sold 10. And so he had to buy the other copies back from the publishers. And he lived with his sister Sophia in Concord, and he lived up in the attic. And recording his diary, he said, "I now have a library of over 1,000 books, 990 I've written myself." So when you don't see your teacher on the bestseller list, well, wait a century or two. Here's what Eric Neumann wrote about Henry Moore's sculpture in the archetypal world of Henry Moore, one of the books that we used along with Frank Lloyd Wright's Writings and Buildings. We paired those two, Moore and Wright, together. Because Moore and Wright both dealt with the arcane qualities of space and form in their balance, in their equilibrium. Neumann was a psychiatrist in Tel Aviv. He was one of the best of the Jungians. He wrote a book called The Great Mother, The Origins and History of Consciousness, a number of books. He writes about Moore. The emergence of an archetype, that is to say, a collective unconscious content, collective unconscious content, an archetype, active in the psyche of large numbers of people, makes itself felt in many fields. Its coming to consciousness finds expression in psychic disturbances as well as creative processes of art. Now let's pause there for just a second. Let's try to get this straight. Here's a very high-priced psychiatrist who says that psychic disturbances are related to creative processes in art. How come? It's difficult to formulate unless you have an energy distributing index so that you can keep track of where things are and why things are related. It's called in anthropology kinship. You got to know who's the mother of who, who's the father of who, in order to get why this who is like that to this child, because here's the mother, here's the father. Once you get that kinship relationality, which has to do with form relationality, with the structure of form. Now, what do psychic disturbances? Psychic disturbances are like glitches in ritual. They're like kinks in existence. And they cause that perturbation, not because people are just ornery and they make up things. The Marx Brothers made up things. That's not the same as psychic disturbances. A psychic disturbance, like is being talked about here, is like there is some kind of a glitch in the way things are done or the way things happen in the ritual comportment, which is the most basic objectivity in the universe. Remember, we talked about how nature is not really there. Nature is not statically objective at all. It's a matrix of change. But what's really there objectively is what is done, what we do, our actions. When we do something, that really is there. And glitches in that ritual activity, make psychic disturbances. It's not done right. It's not working right. It's not happening. It's upsetting, that kind of thing. Why is that related to creative processes in art? Because art and ritual have a quality of complementation. How is that so? Why is that so? If you don't know the energy cycle in its square, there's no way other than just guessing or in examining thousands of cases and hoping that you draw the right conclusions. But you don't have to have thousands of patients and hope you draw the right conclusions. You can understand the form of how things are and their relationality and see for yourself. We saw in the first year that nature gets objectified in ritual, and that ritual then in turn spurs a process which is known as myth. It has to do with language, has to do with experience. Ritual has to do with existence. Myth has to do with experience, with language. So the process of language is very much like another ocean, like nature is an ocean. Ceaseless, always going on. And the island of ritual, the continent of ritual, is really solid, basic dry land in between those two oceans. And just as ritual is an objective dry land of existence that emerges out of the ocean of nature, existence is like the existence of things. They're like islands that come out of universal change. What comes out of the ocean of language are minds. Minds are like very objective. Minds are like dry land coming out of the ocean of language. Symbols. Symbols are as objectively real as actions. Now that whole ecology, those four together, are the square of what we would call what is. They're the ecology, they're the total of the integration way in which energy happens in this universe. But that's not a dead end. The mind is never a dead end unless it's co-opted into some kind of ego structure, even large ego structures like the Egyptian cosmology. What comes out of this is a transformation into a whole different energy mode, the differential mode. Instead of integration, it then works the other way. And one sees the archetype of this, for instance, in ancient dance. Ancient dance forms always took your ambulation in a sunwise motion. And when it was carried all the way through, there was a pivot, there was a turn. And the motion was then carried the other way back through, a counter motion. And this particular form, a clockwise motion, a turn, and a counterclockwise motion, is the basic archetype of sacred dance movement. It's the basic archetype of episodic movement in sacred dance. Dance being the most pervasive ritual comportment on the planet. Bees dance, we dance, birds dance, animals dance, dance. In fact, a Harvard man named Carl von Frisch did a whole book on the dance language of bees one time and showed that they actually have a communication form out of dance, because bees use dance movements as their grammar, and the choreography is the syntax. Nature, ritual, myth, symbol. Now that particular square is very stable, but it also admits of this pivot, this turn, which is inner realization. Integration goes as far as it can. It gets as powered and as interior as it can, and then it reverses itself and comes back out. It's like the process of breathing. Finally have to breathe out. It's the way reality works. Whatever is wound up, whatever is integrated, eventually needs to come back out and differentiate. But the forms and processes of differentiation are different from the forms of integration. They're different but related, just like yin and yang are related. So when a differential phase comes into play, by virtue of its coming into play, an integrative process or form goes hidden. Doesn't disappear, it just goes hidden. As a psychologist would say, it becomes subconscious. What becomes subconscious when vision comes into play? this is extremely important here. When vision comes into play, nature goes subconscious. So instead of having nature, ritual, myth, symbol, you now have vision, ritual, myth, symbol. You have a different square, still a square. Because at any given time, in this world, only that square can manifest itself. The other aspects of that energy cycle, the other aspects of things, have to be hidden. They're there, but they don't show. They only show by a hidden influence on the way in which energy is distributed. Now, when art comes into play, what does it displace? It displaces ritual. It isn't the old 19th century romantic idea that art is anti-ritual. That's not it at all. It's that it transforms ritual the way that magic transforms nature. One of the easiest ways to think of it is the old traditional alchemical way. Magic is a distillation. A distillation so that it's like a super essence. Vision displaces nature because it's like a distilled transcendental super essence. And art displaces ritual. Now look what happens. Art displaces existence. It's not that existence goes away, but that the objectiveness in art is not existence-based, but is person-based. To Schiller, the artist was a hero because the artist saved the universe from the limitations of mere existence. It isn't that existence is mere, it's very vast, but the potential in a differential way is much greater. When persons are real and take the ball, instead of just having a conditioned universe, you have an unconditional universe. Anything is possible. Anything whatsoever. Infinity is possible. But look at the square after art. We had nature, ritual, myth, symbol. Then vision replaced nature. Art replaced ritual. What replaces myth? History. So that you have vision, art, history, symbol. Now that square is also very stable, but it's very, very difficult to work with. And part of the curse of our times is that no one's working with that square very well. Oh. If you try to use the forms of myth to condition history, you get a regressive quality to the square. You get something like Nazi Germany. We've had enough of that. Or you get something like Stalinist Russia. Or there are even worse things, which we don't ever have to face if we don't follow those regressive modes. We don't ever have to get into the totalitarian tyrannies of DNA engineering, which are just nightmares, or nuclear war. We don't have to do that. There's no necessity whatsoever. But obviating that means bringing into play the differential conscious processes of history so that myth can do its hidden work subconsciously, and history can do its process consciously. But the trigger on that activity is art. And art then is extremely important. What's the social significance of art? Art is the objective trigger by which this whole process, history and myth, in its balance, its need for equilibrium, is even accessible. Because without art, without the artist, without the person, there's no way that those energies are even within range of having anything to do with. You can't do anything with them at all until you're brought to that level. So let's listen to Neumann again on Henry Moore with better ears. The emergence of an archetype, that is, collective unconscious content, active in the psyche of large numbers of people, makes itself felt in many fields. Its coming to consciousness finds expression in psychic disturbances, as well as the creative processes of art, in sociological changes, as well as the revaluations of philosophy. One of the central problems of our age is the activization of the earth archetype, and more particularly of the feminine archetype in general. This archetype compensates the crisis of our one-sided patriarchal culture, for it symbolizes the essence of human relatedness, whose source lies at the primary relationship to the mother. Through his ceaseless formation and transformation of this central content, the earth archetype, the feminine, the maternal, through his ceaseless formation and transformation of this central content, Henry Moore has not only created a corpus of great works of art, but is helping a new age into being. The birth of the feminine archetype in modern man, and it should be activization here, not just birth, signifies at the same time the development of human relatedness, of social capacity, and the growing consciousness of the unity of mankind on earth. Now that's why this education is called ecumene. The Greek word ecumene means the one familyness of man. It means that if you follow relatedness, you find that we are all related. That there is a peculiar quality, but that the relatedness of all of us in terms of a single form, a single species, is like a cosmos. It's like a galaxy. It's such a large form, it's difficult to keep track of. Now that happens to be a problem that is central to the way in which we are trying to understand the history of our species. Called evolution. That the way in which evolution works vis-a-vis our species is a knot. It's a problem in history, in historical consciousness, that is tied, is knotted exactly at a point which is a significant threshold of either getting it and moving on, or not getting it and regressing. It's very peculiar. Why is this particular issue so difficult? And the first time that this was seen in a really balanced way was 1972, only 23 years ago. Sure, there were great mystics, there were great poets who had intimations of immortality and wrote these things, but it never got through to a large enough general public so that people understood, well, here's an issue. This is an important issue. Two guys in New York City, one of them, I think, at Columbia, Stephen Jay Gould, and the other at the American Museum of Vertebrates there. This is what curator of American Museum of Natural History, Niles Eldredge. and Stephen Jay Gould in 1972 wrote an article that appeared in a scientific journal having to do with paleontology, the study of fossils, billion-year-old fossils, largely called trilobites and things like that. In their article, they came up with a concept called punctuated equilibria. That evolution is a very curious process. It has an ongoingness, but it doesn't have the kind of ongoingness that was assumed by Darwin and almost all evolutionists up until about 1972. They assumed that change takes place over billions of years. But these guys, who were used to looking at billion-year-old creatures and seeing life in terms of durations, where they've existed for billions of years, did not find the evidence of evolution at all. And so a lot of paleontologists said, well, evolution is mystical. It's not scientific. Trilobites were the same for a billion years. They never changed. In their article, though, they showed that change, rather than taking place very slowly over billions of years, happens all of a sudden. And that what you have is a change that took place because of a jump in the equilibrium of a species. And when the energy change jumped, instead of just having one more example of the same species, you had a couple, two or more, new species. Not just mutations. Not mutations that were sterile, like a mule. Not mutations in that sense. But that all of a sudden, a species which is stable, which reoccurs, can repopulate itself, jumps in its energy form, and new species occur. Now, this is a process that you will recognize as a differential energy. In other words, history is a differential energy. Evolution needs to be understood as a conscious energy which fans out. It makes more. It makes more, better, different. More, better, different, more, better, different. That's its cheer. More, better, different. Remember we talked about how the French underground philosophers, newspaper writers like Camus and Sartre and Maurice Merleau-Ponty, driven against the psychic wall by the occupation of France, came out with this tremendous idea of the existential imperative, that they were fed up with the German categorical imperative from Immanuel Kant, that categorical imperative that produced that Teutonic sameness, that before you do anything, you have to ask yourself, well, what if everyone did this? And usually that curtails action. Whereas the French underground came up with the existential imperative that asked the opposite question, what if no one did this? And very often, the answer is, if no one did this, the universe will be minus this value. That's a differential ethic. Try something new. Not just something new, but raise the energy of this particular ritual to level of art, and you get that newness. Novelty for its own sake is just cleverness that degenerates into deceptive trickery without you even knowing it. As they used to say, the demons who are dealing in this card game are really good card sharps. You're never going to catch them. They always win. Look, the deck is stacked. They know how to deal, and you don't even know the game. What kind of a chance do you have? So if you play the game of clever newness for just newness, it's welcome sucker time. Whereas if the person transforms their ritual comportment into a creative process, the very conditions that went to making psychic disturbances now are wind at your back. You don't want to get rid of those psychic energies. You don't want to take pills to deaden. You want to have that energy. You need that energy. A lot of recalcitrant stuff around. You need that fire. You need that stubbornness. You need that ability to take it in the chops and turn around and take it again and still keep going. Now, it has its own little masculine, reductive, stupid way of being delivered. I think in one of John Ford's movies, he had John Wayne deliver the little dictum to the young guy. He said, well, you're just learning how to be a man, and being a man is getting up one more time than you've been knocked down. But in art, in the art of person making, the alchemy is conscious. You don't have to cross your fingers and your eyes and your toes, hoping that the navel's going to flower. So what if there are yogis in the Himalayas that can do that? Do they have insurance? So what we're exploring is we want to learn how to cook. We don't want to just hope that the guy back there is going to serve us good food. We want to learn how to cook. I'll get my own ingredients, thank you. I think is the feminine way of expressing it. By shifting to a differential mode and raising the energy level, consciousness distills new horizons. Vision distills the person, and history distills the cosmos. The cosmos comes, as we'll see, in the second half of this year. The cosmos is very alive, cool, because it is the distillation of all the histories of all the planets and all the star systems. Cosmos is really in. No matter what galaxy you go to, it's happening. Our participation on that level of the real is the invitation that something like the ecumene education extends. It's not selling a bill of goods. It's saying you don't need a ticket to ride, but you do have to climb on board. With the Chambers Brothers song, people get ready. You don't need no ticket, you just climb on board. I remember the Chambers Brothers had one white guy in there, and they were always very proud. We have our Uncle Tom. Here's what Eldridge, in his book, Time Frames, it's been reprinted several times, so Princeton University Press paperback. It's getting the status of a minor classic now. In the chapter on the emergence of punctuated equilibrium, he's talking about how when you look at large scale, when you shift to large scale, and the example he uses in here is the 1966 film Fantastic Voyage with Donald Pleasence and Reckwell, Welch and Stephen Boyd, where they're reduced down to microscopic size and injected into the bloodstream of this patient, and they have to go in and do some stuff. He says, what was amazing was to see visually how much space there is in bodily fluids and processes, that in the blood, from our standpoint, like it's really thick, but when you get down to microscopic size, where your ship is the size of a cell, the plasma fluid of blood is mostly just this clear viscous liquid. The same with like a galaxy. This particular galaxy is a long ways away, millions of light years, about 25 million light years away. If we were near there, if we were in there, we wouldn't see that. We're in a galaxy and we didn't see it until Hubble figured it out in the early 1930s. Said all the stars that we see and several hundred thousand we don't see make up one form, our galaxy. And that all the myths about the Milky Way are true because it is like the cosmic milk of light seen on its edge, that our galaxy has a particular slant. In fact, all galaxies are thinner than the sheet of paper. All star systems are thinner than the sheet of paper. So they are literally evanescent disks that are mostly space that shine. Not in darkness, but in an infinite velvet openness, so vast and so glowing with so many kinds of radiation that to our eyes tuned to Earth, it looks dark. But if you don't look through eyes, which are supposed to work only in daytime on a planetary level, if you look through eyes that could see the entire electromagnetic spectrum, you would see that the universe is not dark at all, but is a glow so bright that translated into visual light, you couldn't stand to look at it. And that's only the electromagnetic spectrum. Because the electromagnetic spectrum is very low on the totem pole of energy in the real. Its complement, the magnetoelectric spectrum, is 10 billion times the frequency. 10 billion times. Think of the most powerful energy in the electromagnetic spectrum, a supernova, and multiply that by 10 billion times. So that the total glow of the cosmos is stupendous radiance. The mystics staggered into stuttered silence trying to talk about what God's beauty would be like. There's no way, no way you can say. Space. Mostly, these very large entities are space. So he writes here. Eldridge is writing. Another thing Miss Welch encountered was space. Big as those cells and antibodies were, there was far more clear plasma than cellular bodies in that bloodstream. Once the blood was magnified and no longer seemed to be just liquid, the way our ordinary senses proclaim it to be, once the individual bodies that make up the solid matter of blood had appeared, the next obvious thing was the space between the particles. It's the same apparently with just about anything. Viewed at the proper scale, most things turn out to be mostly space. Now the holes, the spaces in Henry Moore's sculpture are just as important. How important? They are exactly as important as the form. The spaces of Moore and the forms of Moore have exactly a punctuated equilibria on level of the objectivity of the work of art. Now, fortunately, there are 10 examples of Henry Moore sculpture in Beverly Hills, Beverly Hills Civic Center. I think it's the largest exhibit of Moore sculpture put outdoors since the Florence, Italy exhibition of some while ago. Moore loved being on top of one of the old palazzos in Florence and seeing his sculpture on the roof of another palazzo, and it was against the dome of Brunelleschi, and 500 years difference, and they sang together. And he was really grateful that this was to him a sign that his art was alive. Because all great art vibrates together. It has an ineffable quality. And once you have mastered the appreciation of any art, all the other arts become available to you. Each of the arts in antiquity had a muse. And the nine muses together formed the spectrum, the prismatic spectrum of consciousness. And when you put the nine muses together, their focus is Apollo. His Homeric epithet was the far darter, the foreseer, the Promethean quality of consciousness. That when the nine female muses of art are aligned up, the zero masculine quality of adventuring thusness comes into play in a way that it had never done before, that it didn't even know it could do. Instead of having the shoulder up strut of John Wayne, learns how to do a Nureyev mid-air pivot. And the masculine learns something about its nature it never knew before. About what it is to have a cosmic relatedness and how reality then is no longer earthbound, though earth originated, is able to go out and fly. And the blinders come off, and the little boy bullshit games become uninteresting. And what becomes interesting is a new world of love. Wow. And we'll talk about that next week. Thanks.